Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Sharif Vakili, investor at Polaris Partners and primary care physician at Stanford. Join Sharif in exploring the extra clinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is a cardiologist and the former chief medical officer of Verily Life Sciences, Dr. Jessica Mega. Welcome to the podcast. Today we have with us Dr. Jess Mega, a prominent practicing cardiologist and healthcare executive who has made significant contributions to the field of medicine and drug development. Jess is one of the founders of Verily Life Sciences, an Alphabet company focused on healthcare innovations, and served as the chief medical officer and chief scientific officer for Verily. Jess has also held several leadership positions in healthcare and is currently on the board of the Danaher Corporation, which is a large Fortune 500 conglomerate of medical industrial products and services. Jess, I'm grateful for you making the time to join us on the podcast today. Thanks for being here.
It's amazing to be here. Thanks.
Jess, you've had a distinguished career as a cardiologist, and you ran several landmark trials as an academic. Can you share a little bit about how you got started and how you got to where you are today?
So much of my career was really rooted originally in patient care, because I think there is no more special career than what patients allow us to do, and that is to partner with them sometimes at the most critical moments of their lives. And so I worked for many years as a critical care cardiologist. And what you realize when you are working with patients and in the system is the only way you get a new medicine or a new device or even an AI-empowered clinical decision support tool into the hands of patients and clinicians is through evidence and through conducting trials, because we have to make sure that whatever we do adds value, that it's effective and it's safe. And so my career always was rooted in the patients, but I got quite interested in clinical trials, really understanding at a time when to cath someone, when to use statins. It's sometimes interesting when I round, I go back to the early trials and say, we didn't know a lot that we now know today. And there's been a huge improvement in mortality and morbidity, certainly based on clinical trials. So it was rooted in patients. I got interested in trials. But then what was eye-opening is you end up publishing results in something like the New England Journal of Medicine, and you publish a Kaplan-Meier curve and you show a reduction in mortality. But what does that mean for individual patients? And that really led to the second arc of my career, getting involved with genomic technologies at a time where the human genome had just recently been sequenced. And so this idea of understanding more deeply how patients respond to therapy led to work in pharmacogenetics and understanding how patients respond, for example, to clopidogrel. And there it led to a third arc of deep data and understanding multidimensional data. And that's how I found myself partnering with Google and coming out about 8 years ago to join Google X and ultimately help co-found Verily. So I would summarize by saying always rooted in patient care. I think physicians bring an incredibly powerful lens as we navigate, whether it's trials, whether it's new genomic technologies, whether it's new technologies in the sphere of AI. These are all at the intersection of technology, life science, and healthcare. And that's been the overarching theme.
Yeah, super cool. So what was the first trial you got involved with? What were you looking at? How'd you get involved with it?
So one of the first trials that I worked with, and I'll just let everyone know, I worked with a group called the TIMI Study Group. It's embedded in Harvard Medical School. It has a long legacy of conducting large international clinical trials. And so typically our trials would be in greater than 40 countries, so a very international base, over 1,000 sites. And one of the first trials that I was involved in, really as an intern, and I was helping with, I would say, a very rudimentary type of work, but it was at the time where TIMI was conducting and part of a trial called Prove It. And it had two different arms. We only really talk about one arm today, which is the arm of the trial that looked at intensive versus moderate lipid lowering. And in fact, we really didn't think there was going to be a huge difference. We didn't know. And the community learned quickly at the end of the trial that actually reducing LDL had a huge impact on patients with cardiovascular disease. What was interesting, there was another arm looking at gadafloxacin and whether there was some sort of component there. We don't talk as much about that because of how the world evolved, but I just remember realizing so acutely the power of randomization, the power of excellent study design. And so that became, I became a convert and really realized that I wanted to be part of clinical trials and the evidence generation to support care.
How long did that project take? Like, what was your role in it and how did that evolve over time?
Yeah, so that particular project was evolving in with a huge amount of leadership over many years. Again, my role there was really more, it kind of, I caught the bug. The trial that I was most closely, let's say, involved with for many, many years, or I should say the product was an anticoagulant. And it was an anticoagulant that had been tested in pulmonary embolus and other kinds of conditions. For many years, we were treating people with warfarin. And I think everyone who's listening knows that warfarin, while incredibly powerful, is associated with some of the highest adverse events just because of getting the dose right. It changes. You would be on a very different dose than I would be on based on our biology, our medications, our genetics. And so there was a wave of what at the time were called novel oral anticoagulants. And I was able to be involved with the development of the use of these medicines broadly, and particularly in acute coronary syndromes. And so these programs, I would say, lasted from the kind of phase 2A to 2B all the way to phase 3, probably about 7 years of my life. And again, what an amazing journey. These, as I like to say, clinical science is team science. So it really takes a village. And as I'm thinking about all the investigators around the world and the companies that I got to work with on this. So that was where I really invested a huge amount of my time.
So were you a fellow at the time? Were you an attending, or you were an academic at that time? Were you a PI? What was the way in which you were, what was your, I guess, launch pad, if you will, to get involved in these kind of projects?
Yeah, I really almost professionally grew up with this study. So I started some early clinical trials work, working as a resident, and then started to work on this program more deeply as a fellow. And then when I went on faculty, continued as the program evolved. And so it's almost, as I think about it, I was it held my hand through my professional early career. And I think you always want to see things through. I talk a lot about arcs and, you know, when do you want to make sure you've seen something through? And that was certainly a huge arc in my life.
And there was this at the Brigham?
Yeah. So this was at the Brigham. And I mentioned earlier the TIMI study group. The TIMI study group was part of the Brigham and also part of Harvard Medical School. So I spent a large portion of my time in Boston, at the Brigham, also at Mass General. I did my fellowship there. And so got to see a diversity of, even though, I mean, overall, I think the two programs are more similar than different. It's really nice to be able to just see how different people practice in slightly different environments.
Do you have any advice for residents, fellows, interns, or even medical students who want to be involved in a big study and want to get more involved in clinical trials? Are they out there? Is that something that's challenging to find? Is that something that you can even start as an idea yourself, at least especially when you come to these big drug trials that tend to be very, like you said, to take a village to coordinate. Any advice on how to approach that?
Absolutely. So there are many ways to get involved in clinical trials. So you have the large international trials that I mentioned a minute ago, and we were part of the coordinating center. So we would be operating as the primary investigators. We would be working with a team thinking about how to deploy these studies. But as I mentioned at the beginning, in most of our studies, there were over 1,000 sites. And so we also, I personally operated as a local site PI. There, the only way clinical trials happen is this network of investigators. And so there are many ways to get involved, even to see if it's something that you're interested in long-term. The other ways, and I'll just mention some other ways, clinical trials, they get conducted, but then there's a huge amount of information there. And there are people who are doing research inside of those trials, right? So I mentioned at the beginning, getting really interested in genomics work. And all of that genomics work was embedded inside this amazing asset, this amazing clinical trial. So there's research inside. And then the last one is conducting what people call investigator-initiated studies. So you might have an idea that you have been, it's keeping you up at night. You see this every day when you go in the hospital and you say, gosh, you know, I really think that we need to invest and understand this idea. And so that's a place where I personally have been involved doing a project that I thought really needed to be done. I held what they call an IND, which is its own beast. And I'm happy for any listeners, if they want to chat about that, let me know. But there are many ways, again, to get your own questions answered and figure out partners to make that happen. So I just remind people, there's a whole world out there. And the last piece I'll say is, you know, we think a lot about pharma-related trials, but there's biotech, there's device companies, all the new digital health companies. We're going to need evidence. And so all of these are places to think about working.
If you think about the ideas that may be bubbling up in the minds of young future doctors and physician scientists, some of the ideas may be around drugs that are on the market and how they could be used differently. Some ideas may be on new drugs and therapeutic modalities. In order to take that energy and sort of pressure test it and see if it's worthy or sort of get mobilized resources in a movement around it, who are some of the important people to talk to or questions to make sure you sort of are answering for yourself to see if you can take that idea and make it into something that you can build a career around?
Yeah. So something that we didn't have, again, a long time ago was clinicaltrials.gov. And so now you can go to clinicaltrials.gov. You can look at what kind of trials that are out there. For certain types of trials, there's actually a requirement to register with these services. So I just think it's a fun place. And maybe, you know, someplace for people to start, right? So take a look at what people are doing, what's out there. You can search by different terms. So that's just a very kind of almost kind of a wide aperture place to start. Another thing to think about, and we always have to think about, is their equipoise. And equipoise, right, is this idea of, are two different strategies, do we really not know the right path forward? And a lot of times, you know, the reason I, you know, really appreciate the physician mindset as we think about these problems is, a lot of times you're walking around and you see this. And so you put an order in and you think, gosh, I could do this or I could do that. And there's just nothing in the guidelines. And again, it depends on, some careers have very extensive guidelines. I think as rare diseases are starting to be diagnosed more and as we're starting to understand more, there's going to be less in terms of guidelines. So there's going to be even more questions that we need to answer. But those are two just places to start. There's online resources, there's what you're clinically observing. And then as I've found it, people are really interested in talking to one another if they're trying to solve problems. And so I think bouncing ideas off of one another, I mean, we're a huge network of individuals. And sometimes we just get so caught up in our day-to-day that we don't sort of pop up and realize, well, there's a lot of people to reach out to.
Talking about different ways to advance innovations, from your academic career at Harvard and then Stanford, you made a transition to private industry. Can you share a little bit about how that transition took place, or if you might have any insights on how to approach private industry or talk to private industry from academia?
Right. So there are many ways. I'll bring up two points. One is, there are many ways to think about working with and funding different research, right? So a lot of times we think about NIH grants, and certainly, I personally spent time doing that. I think there's a language that you learn to apply as you go through that process. There are foundations that are out there. And I think a lot of times that actually we know less about those. And as we start to look around, there are more foundations that are available. And then there's what they call public-private partnerships. And I think that's, as we mentioned, you and I were talking about investigator-initiated work. That's just a great place to think about. And then personally, I should mention that I believe that there's probably less of a dichotomy between academia and industry and all of these different entities. It's more about what the problems you're trying to solve. So even today, as I spend more time with my predominant hat being in industry, I have the really good fortune of seeing patients at Stanford, and they're tremendous. And the ability to work with them and also with medical students, residents, and fellows is the highlight to me. And so I think, as I sometimes like to think about it, falling in love with the problems that we're solving is really a great true north. And then we just create the structures around us to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Might you have any advice for those who might be interested in exploring the transition to private industry, and or any questions they should make sure they're asking themselves?
So a number of things come to mind. The first one is, you can kind of almost, there's the rip the Band-Aid off and jump right into industry. And then there's kind of the sticking your toe in the water. And so there are a number, you know, we think about the conferences that come most easy to us, right? So there's probably some conference you like to go to every year, and you see your friends and you feel really comfortable. As it turns out, every industry has its own set of conferences. And so there are ways to even just, and now that a lot's online, start looking at some of these resources. Go and attend. I used to, when I was early getting into genetics and genomics, I would go to these incredibly technical, very basic science conferences, and they were kind of like, what lab are you with? I was like, oh, I'm with the Mega Lab. Yeah. And, you know, I would just be there totally out of my depth, but I learned so much, and it made me more excited at that moment to get involved with those tools and technologies. In your case, you're asking about advice about industry, but I just think that there's a way to start to listen to how people will talk. What are they talking about? So that's one, I think, easy way. The second thing is, you know, as it turns out, a lot of companies are looking for consultants, people who can lend medical expertise in a particular area. And so that can be something as people early in their career because of the experiences that you've had, or later in people's careers as people serve on advisory boards and really shape the direction of, for example, drug development. So there's the lowest touch is, you know, looking online, going to conferences. The second one is consulting. And then the third one is talking to people who are in industry and who have made that transition. And I've seen many people who say, hey, you know, I know there's the soft step, but I want to just get right in there. And they've done extremely well.
I want to actually now talk about your transition here then, because you were one of the co-founders of Verily, and Verily's had quite an impact and a lot of evolution over the years. I'm curious how Verily came to be, how you ended up being involved in that, those early days, and how has its mission evolved in the 7 years now since it was founded?
So going back to that moment where I was involved in clinical trials and was working with genomics, and where I found myself was very quickly involved in the big data and deep data revolution that was going on. And so we were generating so much information. And in fact, we were outstripping the compute capacity to even do our work. And so you knew that there were questions to be answered, but the infrastructure just wasn't supporting it. And so I found myself really on a journey to figure out, were there companies out there, were there groups out there that could help us build infrastructure to handle multidimensional data so that we could push forward in life science and healthcare. And so ended up talking to a number of different groups and realized that it was actually not going to be something where it would happen in silos, but you were going to need physicians and scientists and software engineers and hardware engineers and designers to be able to build this next generation set of tools and technologies to really get to the heart of precision medicine and precision health. And so it really was almost falling in love with this problem of how do we use information to help patients that drew me out to California. And now, as you said, nearly 8 years ago, actually more than that. So,
oh, wow.
I came out here, joined Google X, which was a place with the driver, well, what was called at the time, the driverless car. There were energy programs going on, and it was just a very interesting time being a physician inside of a tech company. And being there was it was just so eye-opening, humbling in a way, right? Because in medical education, you kind of get training along the way and you typically generally know what's next. And here I was in an entirely different environment. But there were kind of two take-home messages. One is that multidisciplinary teams see things differently. And I think they can create a new set of tools and businesses and solutions for patients. The second thing is we realized, as powerful as it was being there, that if we created an entity, which we called Verily, as a company solely focused on life science and healthcare, we were going to be able to build out the quality systems and the regulatory systems, a lot of the kind of guts of what you really need to operate in the space. And so we took the plunge, and it's been an amazing journey ever since.
Wow. So when you came to Google X, were you confronting letting go with your clinical practice? How did that decision come to be? Was it an easy decision? What was that transition like?
So I sometimes think about things as a push and a pull. So, you know, push, right, is this like, oh, I'm done with this, I gotta go. And it was never that. I have to say, I was a very happy academic. And it was more this pull towards seeing what could be if we pulled these different teams together and what we could create. And so that changes the mindset a bit. The other thing that was, I feel really fortunate about, is I did continue to see patients as I came to Stanford.
Well, that's awesome.
And so just part of it, I'll tell you, it was for many reasons. One is we started our conversation today talking about what are the problems that I personally get excited about. And it always starts and is very centered around patients. The second one is the ability to be part of the next generation of healthcare. I'll tell you, I learn as much from the students, residents, as fellows as I give. And then the third thing is, if you are in the setting of building companies, so if you're doing company creation, you're building new tools and technologies, understanding really the problem that you're solving is incredibly grounding. Because you can get kind of caught up. You know what doctors really need? Doctors really need another app. I mean, that's what they, and then you're rounding, you're thinking, that is like 100% not what I need. I need a reduction in fragmentation across the healthcare system. I need a way of ensuring that the transition from a patient being inpatient to home goes more smoothly. It just, I think, keeps you grounded in the problems that are biggest and that need to be solved. So I have found it to be good for my soul, good for my clinical practice, and good for business.
Do you think that if you were to have gone back, it was important for you to do cardiology fellowship and have that career as an academic before transitioning over? I'm curious if you have any perspectives on those who are wondering whether it might make sense to try to go into industry, particularly at a place like Google, maybe right out of medical school or right out of IM residency. Did you even anticipate that you would make that transition from the get-go? And, you know, reflecting back in hindsight, would you have explored things any differently? Or did you feel like that was what made most sense for you and your passion?
So I never would have imagined the journey. And in fact, people sort of famously say that in hindsight, you can connect all the dots,
yeah,
and you can create this narrative. But in the moment, the dots are kind of out there in front of you. It's I wasn't sort of part of some big intentional journey. But what I will say is, I think the reason that I was able to add value at that moment in the company is because of the work that I had done, because my understanding of what it means to take care of patients, what does it mean to run large-scale clinical trials, work with biopharma and biotech, partner closely with regulatory agencies, the FDA, EMEA, what does it mean to get a product into the market? Those were the kinds of things that were important as we were building the company. Now, people frequently ask me, wait, do I have to go to medical school and residency and fellowship in order to work, you know, in health tech, for example, or in industry? And I say, absolutely not. There are so many ways to work in those places. The reason to do those things that you and I just talked about is because you want to take care of patients, and that's your orientation. Or you want to understand that industry deeply. And when by industry, I mean like healthcare as an industry. But if you're interested in being involved, but that piece isn't important to you. People can go into doing business development, product management. There's so many different ways. Now, again, those require their own sets of expertise, but it's not critical for a career, for example, in health tech.
Yeah, beautifully summarized. I couldn't agree more. Can you share a little bit about what the role of being the chief medical officer or chief scientific officer Verily entailed and how you felt your experiences were being translated there?
So it really was interesting. It certainly evolves over time, much like anyone who's been part of an early enterprise. And I'll sort of open our minds to anyone who's been part of an early team with a few people. So at the beginning, in some ways, there's really no, you know, this concept of like staying in your lane. There's a lot of outside your lane. I mean, you need to do what needs to get done to make sure you're building the best products that can be in the universe, right? And so there was a lot, we were thinking about a number of different devices and molecular tools to create new multidimensional data and then software platforms to then apply them to clinical research and to care. And so in the very early days, I would say it was much more fluid in terms of directly working with product and working with the engineers. Over time, and the role of a chief medical and scientific officer, which by the way, means something different. What I've come to realize is I think it means something a little different in every single company. But I'm sure you've seen that. And I think that's kind of just something to pay attention to. I think it's a little different than something where we can very easily say, this is the skill set. But in my case, I was working directly with our scientists. So a large number of people working on things like digital pathology, molecular profiling, our clinical scientists and our clinical strategy team, clinical development and operations, regulatory quality teams, biostatistics, epidemiology, and data management. Those were the types of functions. And then we would have individual lines of business that included their own P&L management, their own revenue generation. So I felt in some ways lucky. I got to work cross-functionally with these functions across the whole team and then go deep in certain business lines. So that's how it evolved over time. But again, I think there's just so many shapes and forms and also different ways that people with an MD degree can contribute in industry.
Yeah, I appreciate you explaining it in that way, because you're absolutely right. We've had a handful of chief medical officers on the podcast. We have chief medical officers of biotech cell therapy companies, a very different job from chief medical officer of a like the former chief medical officer of Lyra, is a big mental health company, chief medical officer of a smaller mental health company. So it's so interesting to think about what it means to be, we have the chief clinical officer of Google, like what it means to be the chief medical officer of a sort of entrepreneurial startup within a big tech company. Every role is different. So I'd actually like to ask if you had a take, given Verily's known focus on data-driven approaches to healthcare, can you talk about some of the ways in which Verily has been using data-driven innovation in healthcare and how you see the trend evolving in the future, especially with the proliferation of generative AI and a lot of the new tools that are out there for the field to grapple with and learn?
So Verily was able to, one, think about particular areas where there was new data that was needed to understand precision medicine and health. And one example there was in deep immune profiling. And so if you think about it clinically, we learn about a lot of disease states based on what we see, or we look at people's joints to see if they're inflamed or not. We listen to people's lungs. But this idea that there's actually a deep immune signature that is part of diseases. Now we're starting to appreciate oncology. We're looking at even cardiovascular disease. And so we were able to bring this combination of using new biological tools along with new computational and analytical tools, again, to have a much richer readout. An analogy I make or would make for us today is it's almost like when you see that there's a role for ultrasound, but when you look at an MRI and you see how sharply delineated certain organs can be, I think we're now getting to that stage on the molecular side, but we just didn't have the computational tools to do that in the past. So that's one area. But then what we also are doing is building software platforms, for example, to pull that data in and then run clinical trials more efficiently, working directly with participants, thinking about that patient journey, pulling digital data in from wearables and others, and then conducting longitudinal analyses. And we were able to partner with a number of companies running trials and trying to get information in a more effective way. So those are just two examples that come to mind as I think about places where we see the idea that new tools, technologies, and digital interventions will help. Now, this idea of generative AI, I think is an amazing evolution. You know, we were able to work with a lot of applications of AI, neural nets, particularly around, I talked a little bit about some of the molecular work, but also with things like digital pathology or image analysis. That's based right on ImageNet, training algorithms. You know, we have been doing that since our inception. But now as we move forward, what we're starting to see is this more generative side where you're looking, it's almost like algorithms looking around the corner, right? They're seeing things and anticipating what's next. Again, trained on data, there's many different ways to train. There's taking all of the data. There's taking what is now called reduced or compacted data. But I think that now this idea of this anticipation is going to be quite interesting. And there's a number of different groups thinking about how do you apply this, for example, to drug development. So examples that people frequently talk to are this idea that you can now predict protein folding, for example, in a new way. And how does that get pulled into the next generation of medicines? Or in the same way that you help navigate, let's say there's certain tools that are smartly navigating how people deliver packages and that are those are being deployed today. Are those same tools helping with the healthcare navigation space? So, you know, it's hard to even, I think, open our email or to go to a conference without talking about it. So I think it's a really exciting time. The caveats, right, are, you know, they're still what people call hallucinations. So things come out that aren't quite right. Sometimes people nicely call it confabulation. And we're able to catch it because when you go through medical training, you know, we were trained without these tools. So I can see something and say, yeah, that's about 80% right, or it's 90% right, but we know which pieces aren't. And so I think that same, in my mind, the same principles that we apply to medicines, you know, the clinical trials, safety, efficacy, and value, those are going to be the same lens and the same principles that we're going to be applying now just with a new set of technologies. So I am excited, optimistic, but also having spent time just, I'm equally kind of realistic on what it's going to need in terms of ethical and regulatory frameworks, but it's a great time to be in these fields.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to pivot actually now to a question. It's actually one of the most popular questions I get. I get it both from the medical side of things. I also get a lot from former business school classmates, which is a question around getting involved in board work. You've been very involved doing a lot of board work over the years. Curious if you could share a bit about that experience and how one might be tapped for or enter that kind of work.
Sure. So just as an overview, when we think about boards, right, we're thinking about an executive committee that supervises the activities of an organization. And this can happen in a number of different settings. It can be in the for-profit setting. And in for-profit, it can be a publicly traded company or a private company. And it can also be for not-for-profit entities. And when you're in a private industry, you have certain governance. But when you're in a public corporation, you're typically a fiduciary to the shareholders. So just kind of thinking about it broadly. And the work that you do in a board can be, I think about it on four different levels. One is just the management, right? So how is the management team doing? CEO succession and planning. What about retention? Are employees staying or leaving the company? There are things like large strategic initiatives. You're talking about 3 to 5 year plans. There are major investments. Are you going to acquire a company? Are you going to merge with a company? And then there's the concept of risk, right? And this is right now, cybersecurity. What's going on with the environment? What's going on with international governance right now? So these are just different things that you end up thinking about. I have really, really enjoyed the board work. I have worked with a number of private companies, public companies, educational bodies, as well as nonprofit. And the most interesting thing is almost having to shut off. If you're in an operating, what people call an operating or management role, you've kind of got to shut off that side of your brain and say, what are these other pieces? Because sometimes if you conflate the two, you're probably not doing either one of those jobs particularly well. But that's sort of a big picture. Now, how do people get involved? So it turns out they're boards of so many different things. And I have found that a lot of times talking, we talked earlier about how do people think about industry? And we talked a bit about consulting and helping companies. And this is another way where, depending on your own expertise, and that can be your own clinical area of interest, it could be that you're interested in a certain tool in medicine. So let's say you're really interested in imaging, and there are a lot of imaging companies out there. Maybe you're super passionate about healthcare delivery, and there are groups out there. So I think it takes a little soul searching on where you want to put your energy and what kind of impact you want to have, and then reaching out to people who work in these companies. The other thing is there's the board. And then a lot of times there's also scientific advisory boards or medical advisory boards. So lots of different ways to get involved. But the take home message is there are many shapes and sizes. And I think that's what makes them so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it like being on the board for you of these companies? Where, how do you usually find your area of your superpower sort of coming out and be contribute to the, you know, council of advisors for either a nonprofit or for-profit organization?
So I tend to be someone who really is interested in pattern recognition. So I'll just make a music analogy. I will tend to hear songs and I'll pick out just a few notes and I think they sound very similar. When I turn to my friends and family, they're like, those songs have nothing in common. I'm like, no, they just, these two notes, you just, there's something there for me. And so when I serve on these boards, what I have noticed is I just am looking for certain patterns, almost helping look around corner, saying what could be, you know, what would be a threat or what would be a huge opportunity, and looking at the dots, kind of trying to connect them. So that's just one thing I found interesting regardless of segment that's come up. The other thing is I do tend to like to go pretty deep in the domains. And so sometimes those are domains that are super close to me, and sometimes it requires a ton of education and reading. And I just am a very curious person, probably to a fault. That's probably been some of the driving mission behind my career, but I'm just super curious. And I guess that's one thing I would say is there's certain things that you do that are going to be your responsibilities on a board. And then there's this whole other world of things that you can get out personally if you invest.
Yeah, I love that. The curiosity really resonates because there's so much that is out there to learn, to be able to guide these organizations that have a lot of unknowns before them. Thinking about that, what's it like being on the board of a $200 billion multinational conglomerate?
Well, you know, certainly the excellence I've seen there and the real push now as a science and technology company that really is working across a number of global operating companies has a huge amount of scale. And the things that I've just noticed in particular is their focus really on excellent management, as well as a focus on mergers, acquisitions, and partnerships to drive sustained growth. And I have just, again, seen how they have navigated an incredibly important time. So it's, I'll just say it's an honor to be on the board.
Are you the only physician on the board?
We're actually quite fortunate. There are other people who have clinical backgrounds. But what you'll learn, much like, I guess earlier we were saying that there many people fill different spaces based on their own experience. What I've come to realize is even think about yourself, you know, your background in different spheres, everyone brings their own lens, right? Everyone brings their own, do you come from a different type of healthcare? Do you, did you grow up in academia or an industry? So that's one thing that I guess I'm glad we're talking about. I hadn't thought as much about it before, but sometimes, in this world, we can be quite reductionist. This person has an MD, this person has this degree, but it is really interesting. And even when we were talking about the difference between someone who goes to med school versus someone who's been in the care system for a longer period of time, never underestimate your own pieces that you bring based on your worldview. Not to mention, there's a huge international element to a lot of this. And so we sometimes can become quite myopic with, here's how life science, healthcare, and technology works, but the world is becoming much more global.
Yeah, it's such interesting. There's actually a Harvard Business School case on this exact topic where they talk about boards. And so you climb this virtual Mount Everest and you have people who have their prescribed, if you will, roles or experience. But in order to get to the top, you have to rely on people who might have knowledge that you wouldn't necessarily expect and sort of have that humility to listen. So anyway, it's very interesting that it sounds like that is indeed an important facet of running a big public company.
Yeah, it's using that word, right? You use the word humility. And so in some ways you want to contribute. You want to have your domain. You want to know that there are tangible pieces that you're bringing to the table. And now I think we're talking even more broadly, but I have found that a healthy dose of whether we want to call it openness, humility, curiosity, it goes such a long way. And it's been, I that's where I think I've learned the most when you're stopping and listening a bit and you're riffing with someone else and you're taking yourself in a direction that's new.
Beautifully said. Yeah, absolutely. The last question I have for you, Jess, and it's been such a privilege having you on. It's a question that we've asked everybody, and I'd love to just curious to get your thoughts, however you like to answer it, just in the waves in which you've interacted with this, which is thinking about U.S. healthcare or even healthcare globally. What's something that gives you hope and you're excited about? And what's one thing that if you had the ability to, you had a magic wand to change, you'd like to change?
Okay, so two things that give me hope. So I know I'm magic wanding and bending the rules a little bit with
your
question. Two things that give me hope, and then one thing that I think we all have to pay attention to. So I mentioned earlier, I have the privilege of working with med students, residents, and fellows, and the degree of passion and commitment that I see, I mean, I think the future's so bright, and just it really does genuinely bring me joy in where healthcare is going to go. The other thing is I see an engaged group, and it's not everyone has this luxury as a patient because of circumstances or what's going on in people's lives, but I am seeing a more empowered group of people and patients that want to get involved. And nowadays, I mean, I remember where it was very controversial, where you mean people are going to be able to look up their results and they're going to see their notes and their labs. And the world is morphing a bit where that information is being liberated. And I think people are taking and able to take more ownership there. So I think those are really great trends. What keeps me up and what worries me is the continued fragmentation in healthcare, right? And so information's coming from so many different places and navigating the system can be really hard. And even when people come with great solutions, it just sometimes can be another point solution in an already chaotic world. And so the more we are reducing fragmentation in healthcare, I think the better we're going to be able to get those new life science tools into the system. You talk about years it takes to get things in, but it's also going to help people with kind of basic health. So we should all be paying attention to that because that could hold us back. So hope, challenges, but I can't imagine a better time to be doing it.
I love that. Well, Dr. Mega, thank you so much for taking the time to join the podcast. It was such a privilege to have you on.
It's amazing to be here, and just congratulations on everything you're doing. It's really wonderful.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you have any suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at info@tdio.org.